Hey, it's Brian. Okay, so this week's episode is a special one for a couple of reasons. For one, it's with Tyler Dunn, who's not only one of my favorite writers and one of the best football writers working today, he's also been a very good friend of mine for a long, long time. So it's awesome to get to catch up with him. It was also recorded as part of our first ever live event. So we recorded this episode last week at the Gianduli School of Communication at St. Bonaventure University, where I work, and we had a fantastic group on hand, including one of Tyler's sixth grade teachers. You'll know it when he walks in. Anyway, big thanks to Danny Bush for the technical assistance with this episode, to Aaron Schimble, the Gianduli School, and the Endowment for Excellence in Business Journalism for supporting the event, and for everyone who came out to the event. We're hoping to do more of these in the future, and we'll hope you'll be able to attend. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, everyone. This is The Other 51. I'm Brian, and I'm joined today by a non-St. Bonaventure graduate at St. Bonaventure University, but we won't hold that too much against him, Tyler Dunn. Tyler, welcome back to the show.
It is great to be here. I think we were saying earlier, I feel like an honorary SBU alumni.
100%,
yeah. I took some classes here.
You did?
In high school,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, drank a few beers here. I had a lot of friends that went to Bonaventure, so... I know the lay of the land well. It's an unbelievable school in every possible way. So it is awesome to be here with everybody.
So you weren't a grad, but you were a season ticket holder, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Back to the mid-90s. So we're talking Shandu McNeil, Rashawn Palmer.
Mm-hmm. Kenny McFarlane, your favorite player.
Kenny McFarlane, yeah. There's a story there that we told off the podcast.
Probably
we
don't best, need to get left, into. Off, best yeah. left off the podcast. We'll tell you guys later.
But yeah, it was the Riley Center, man. There's nothing like it. In all sports, I think, you know, growing up, I mean, this is we came to all those games, and we knew it was nuts. But then really when you even – go to other college. I mean, I went to Syracuse, and the dome is wild, right? The mm-hmm. Syracuse, big time D1 basketball. But give me the Riley Center over the dome. Like, seriously, it's just realer. It's more authentic. It's just when you cover the game, when J.R. Bremmer hit that three against Temple,
yeah.
And everybody rushed to the court. I remember doing that as a kid. it was awesome. So I just think the small town nature of Oleana, of Allegheny with the team, it's rare.
So you're a gold uniform guy, right? So remember yeah. those gold uniforms?
That's right.
So you guys have to – this will show up like on 70s sports or throwback. The Bonaventure back in the mid-90s, like for a year or two, had alternate uniforms, and they were gold with like white and brown swirl. I'm not doing them justice, but they were like a yellowish gold uniform.
Yeah.
Which was – yeah. Aaron, you're right on that. They've looked better in other places. They did not do well, but
they were sharp. I loved them.
Of course,
I think we owned them.
Yeah.
You know who was my guy? Qadir
guy?
Habib.
Q Habib.
Yes.
Oh,
did you cover him?
Yes, I did.
So after the games, me and my brother would hang out on the court. Like, that's what was great about Bona games. Like, you could just hang out. Our dad would go up with Jim Barron and hang out at the Hall of Fame. And we'd be down on the court just throwing alley-oops to Qadir Habib. He was just such
a
great guy.
He was one of the – so Qadir Habib, he was a forward. He came from Buffalo. Really great prep player up in Buffalo. And then he played here. I don't think he finished here. I'm blanking. I think he transferred. But just real – good dude, salt of the earth guy, really, really great guy.
Yeah.
So, okay, you guys did not come here to hear the Bonaventure '90s reunion podcast, although that would definitely sell. So, Tyler, we were just talking earlier. You've been speaking to students today. Before we get into the book, you're in year three now, or season three of Go Long, your own thing, your own Substack. How's it going?
It's going great. You know, honestly, the adrenaline rush is still there and stronger than ever. Waking up in the morning and knowing, like, it's on you to produce content that's worth people's time. And mm-hmm. I love that. It's a huge reason I did it, just to try to bet on myself and cover the NFL through that long-form lens. GoLongT.com for anybody out there that wants to sign up. And that's the cool thing about it. I mean, you can hop on the free list, convert, upgrade at any time to becoming, like, a full paid subscriber. But it's great. It's just, you know, it's comforting to know people still want to read long form. And that was the huge unknown with branching off, doing my own thing, is with everything free, with everything at the tip of our finger, us all kind of just mindlessly scrolling through social media apps nonstop. Is there even a market for hitting pause on life? Like, forget the $8 a month. Hitting pause on life and reading a story about a player who went through something traumatic. Maybe there's a profile that, you know, I sat down with a guy, or like the inner workings on a team, like the New York Giants just falling apart, you know, at the seams last season. Like, is there a market for that? And there absolutely is. So that gives me the hope long term that Golong's here to stay for sure.
Yeah, it's a worthwhile read. I think it was the first Substack I paid to subscribe to, and it was easy.
Right?
Oh yeah, it was the easiest decision I made. But you mentioned long form, and that gets us to the fact that you wrote a whole ass book. It's killing me because I haven't written a book yet. But you beat me to the book world. But it is The Blood and the Guts. It is out now. First off, congratulations. You wrote a whole book.
Thanks so much.
Book.
I know it is kind of eerie to see it and hold it. Hey, Mr. Amir, what's up? Good to see you. My sixth grade teacher.
Oh, phenomenal.
In the house. The best sixth grade teacher in the country right here.
Wait.
Oh, my goodness.
Stop it.
Get out of here.
That, ladies and gentlemen, you guys can't see this. We'll have to get a picture of this. It is a Tyler Dunn football card.
The Kendall Oilers midget football.
Okay.
There it is.
Okay, you got to read. Okay, so we got on the front. Let's turn around to the front. Other side's the front, dude. So we got Tyler Dunn, number 13 in your program, number one in your hearts. The Kendall Oilers, 2000 MVP sports cards. I'm assuming that's the brand. Everyone can see. Smiling Jack Tyler Dunn.
Football should be fun. I love smiling
that's
in team
fantastic.
Photos.
All right, so this is.
I can't believe you still have that. That's
so
amazing.
this is a Other 51 exclusive. Can you read the back of the card for us?
Yes, it says the team was the Kendall Oilers, right? Mm-hmm. So in Bradford, Pennsylvania, that was the league I played in. So the Kendall Oilers, midget division. My coach was Jay Beeman, assistant coach not named on the card. Steve Dunn.
Nice.
So he was our assistant.
All right.
Yeah. Quarterback.
Yep.
We had a good squad. I don't think we won it. I think I've got four. I have forearm pads on for some reason. I don't know why a quarterback needs the forearm pads, but I was ready to go just in case to forearm shiver somebody.
That's
oh my
tremendous.
Gosh! Great find.
Yes.
Awesome. We can make that happen. We can do it.
You old yet, Kai?
I feel really old. That's 2000. So
2000.
I was 13 years old. Oh my god!
How old that makes me? I had my first job when you were throwing those passes.
Oh my gosh!
Oh my goodness! All
that
right,
would have been right after Bonas' run, right?
That was the Bonas. Yeah. It was the fall after. Fall after they didn't follow Tayshaun Prince. But anyway, again, moving on from Bonaventure memories. So the book, The Blood and the Guts. So it's about – tell us what it's about, first of all. Give us the quick pitch.
So, you know, for a long time, a lot of people have always asked, like, "What are you going to write a book? What's it going to be about?"
Mm-hmm.
We love reading your long form, and I've always wanted to get into something, but I wasn't really sure what it would be. Like, I feel like if you're going to take on this kind of project, you better be really passionate about it. That's the advice that was given to me, like, from anybody who – took on a book like Seth Wickersham, Jeff Perlman, they all kind of say the same thing. Like, this is going to be on your brain 24/7, 365. So you better be all in. You can't just, as Rex Ryan said, you cannot be half pregnant when you're writing a book. You cannot half-ass something like that. You need to be all in. So I know I love football. I mean, we have a sports card from, you know, playing back in the day. Like, I've, you know, played all growing up, you know, high school, 1 year of college, covered it as far back as I can remember. You know, probably a few NFL previews from Mr. Amir back in sixth grade. And so I love the sport. I love the purity of the sport. I was trying to think, okay, what's the best way to tell the story of pro football? Is it through some of my experiences? Is it something on the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers? I'm like, I don't necessarily know if I want to think about Aaron Rodgers for a couple of years. We won't go down that road. Is it something Buffalo Bills related? You know, living here in Western New York, knowing a lot about the team, the history. Who knows? Maybe that's something down the road, but nothing really clicked quite yet. And just the more I really thought about the game and the sport that we all love, I mean, it's that adrenaline rush. There's just something different about football that I don't think other sports have. It has an inherent risk to it. And that when you put on the pads and you step on the field, you're assuming a risk. Look, if you screw up, you might get your buddy drilled. You might get hurt. There's a pressure to that that gives you a different type of adrenaline rush, and professional football players are like the modern day gladiators, taking that on, the biggest, baddest, meanest, fastest dudes hitting each other at insane angles. So, what's the best way to tell this story? To me, it was the tight end.
Okay.
and I didn't play tight end, so it's not like I have that rooted in my past. I just thought that you've got a block in the trenches, so you've got that nitty gritty grunt work, right? That is real football that we love. But you also have that pressure that comes with needing to catch a ball, on 3rd and 8 with 80,000 screaming fans, millions of people watching at home. Like, there is a lot of glory involved with the position too, and mental pressure, and a level of intelligence where you have to know everything on offense. I mean, next to the quarterback, I don't think anybody on the offensive side of the ball needs to know more than the tight end. That's why there's such good color commentators, like Greg Olson and Tony Gonzalez and Mike Dicka, and they all get into it because they can explain the game in a digestible way. So that's how it started, Brian. Like, okay, I'm just going to throw myself into it and just see where it goes. Like, how the tight end why the tight end is real football, and then it became why the tight end is saving football, and this is where we may disagree. Mm-hmm. I feel like the sport needs to be saved. I watch a game, and I see the flags. I see the fines. It's overly sanitized. It drives me nuts. I feel like my grandfather. I want to take the remote and just chuck it through the TV sometimes. And it's just like I feel like the NFL is searching for this middle ground that doesn't exist. Like, you can't live in the octagon and live in the safe space. You've got to accept the fact that you can make it safer. I don't think football will ever be safe. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. It's not for everybody, and that's okay. And I feel like the NFL is just trying to convince everybody it's safe. So you get to the point where Grady Jarrett is tackling Tom Brady. And, I mean, what is wrong with that play? Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. And we kind of forget about it, right? By Tuesday, we're all setting our fantasy football lineups, and the NFL knows we're going to move on to the next shiny object. All right, they're going to forget about that insane call that's changing the game because our attention spans are like squirrels in 2022. But it just goes into the ether, and it stays there, and it gets a little softer and softer and softer. And that definitely was sprinkled into the thought process for this book too, is like what's going to save that real football that we love so much? And it's that position, that player that does it. So I just started hanging out with tight ends from Dicka to Gonzalez to Coates to Gronk to Kittle. And we'll get into it. It just took on a life of its own where it became even something a little bit bigger than that.
Right. So backing up a little bit. So you got the idea for writing a book on tight ends. I remember you telling me at some point in the past year after you started doing it that you got a book coming out and it was on tight ends. And I was excited because you're writing a book. But I remember thinking, man, that is oddly specific. Like, that is a book about tight ends is not the first thing that I would think about reading a full book about. So did you get that reaction? Did you get that reaction from people? Like, it's a great idea, but it is so like, tight ends, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think that once people read the book and really dive into these personal stories, they'll realize it is way bigger than tight ends. Because I get that. Like, it initially, as I was really thinking this through and thinking about tight ends, I kind of had the same thought. Like, is it too narrow and too niche-y to really generate interest? But it's not. I mean, these guys have wild stories, and it was just a matter of sitting down with them face-to-face. I didn't want to just have a book that's dependent on research and Zoom calls and phone calls. I thought it was important to kind of, like, take the reader on this cross-country journey for the soul of the sport itself through this position. So it's Mike Dicka at his golf course in his 80s, remembering the time where it all could have fallen apart, where he's just depressed and drinking himself into oblivion and, everything's falling apart. I mean, nobody knows that. And who knows where the game is without the real Mike Dicka in full. So there's a lot of personal stories here that I think I don't even really know if you have to be a football fan to read the book because these guys went through so much in their lives that everybody can relate to. I mean, Tony Gonzalez said it best where, like, there's no position in sports that people can relate to in America like the tight end because you just have to do stuff that you don't want to do in life, right? You're paying bills, you're changing diapers, you're doing all kinds of stuff. And at the tight end, you're getting pulled into the 9-on-7 blocking drill and you're doing grunt work that you might not want to do. And you can really see the more you talk to these guys, like how they're uniquely qualified to take that on. Dallas Clark, his mom just dying in his arms. Jimmy Graham fighting for his life, in a group home. There's just some harrowing stories that go into all of their past where it's not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. It's like they weren't tight ends by accident. Like they, the tight end position found them. They didn't choose the tight end position, okay. Which is kind of cool. Because they had this, a certain set of characteristics to them that just, you know, they naturally, by natural selection, like just became tight ends and gravitated toward this position that is the sport, like distilled mm-hmm. to one job.
So, okay, you get the idea. You're going to write a book about it. Like, this is the book. What's your first step? What do you do after you, like, okay, this is definitely the book I'm going to write? What's your next step?
So, it's a book proposal. Okay. And so, I had to write a – and that's kind of boring. Probably bad for a podcast, right?
It's a podcast about writing. This is what we do. So,
So, it was putting together a book proposal and, you know, pitching it to the publishing companies. So, I think when a lot of people put together these proposals, they might have a lot of interviews in the bank, or maybe they wrote stories on the topic or books on the topic. I didn't have any of that when it came to tight ends. Okay. So it was more so like a confidence in, okay, like I'm going to give you this book on this topic. Like at this point, these are the players saving football, and I will get Mike Ditka, Tony Gonzalez, Ben Coates, a handful of these tight ends, and produce this book on this angle, and here are a list of tight ends, and here's why they're important to the sport. And then it was a matter of, you know, the publishing company offering a contract, agreeing to the contract. And then when that was signed, Serafino was born, our son. So our second child is born in late July. I mean, right around the time that I think the contract was signed. And then it was just instantly like trying to set up interviews with these tight ends. And it's like anything in journalism, it's a hunt, it's a search. Like you're trying to find direct numbers on whitepages.com, which is the best kept secret in all of like journalism, is whitepages.com. It is worth the subscription. I remember reading Jeff Perlman's post on writing a book, and he recommended it, and it was like the biggest kick in the ass I ever could have got. Like, just get White Pages and just start reaching out to people, and cell phones, home numbers. It's a great way. I mean, I think I talked to almost 100 people for this book, and a lot of them were on White Pages.
Okay.
But then it's also working through agents. It's working through agencies. It's working through NFL teams. Mm-hmm. It's just really exhausting every outlet at your disposal to find these tight ends.
Right.
Because I think that, you know, I'm not really sure, like, the 12 Publishing, what their expectation was in terms of how many tight ends I would actually talk to directly. I think they were okay with, like, write-arounds and talking to teammates and coaches and scouts and people who – but I only had to really do that for Kellen Winslow and Shannon Sharp.
Okay.
And I loved – those chapters were fun as heck to write. I mean, Shannon Sharp is nuts, as we all see. Terrell Davis had some great stories. Mike Shanahan and Kellen Winslow, like, got Dan Fouts. I almost said Don Coryell. Don Coryell is no longer with us, but it's as much a Coryell chapter as it is a Winslow chapter. And those ex-Chargers were great. But for the most part, I was able to find these tight ends. I mean, they were all about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I was so blessed and fortunate. Like, they were willing to sit down with me and say, yeah, come on down on this date. And Tony Gonzalez just moved to Austin, Texas. He's like, I'll be there this date. If you want to come down, we'll get together. That's, you know, the Soho House, I think it was called, like a social club. And it was great. Jeremy Shockey, same thing in Miami Beach. If you're going to get to know Jeremy Shockey, it's got to be at a bar, right?
In Miami Beach.
In Miami Beach, yep. That was wild. Dick at his golf club. Ben Coates, Jackie Smith just blew my mind. That might have been my favorite conversation of them all.
What's that?
I knew nothing about Jackie Smith. I mean, I only knew what a lot of people of my age see, and that's every Super Bowl, the drop. Dallas, Pittsburgh, 1979. He's the GOAT that is in the back of the end zone, and not the back of the end zone, I think somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Drop the touchdown, and I mean, we could spend an hour
Cowboys,
talking. Jackie
Cowboys
Smith.
Lost that game by four. That would have been that. And they had a field goal. That was the difference in the game. And the famous call is, "Oh, bless his heart, he's got to be the sickest man in America."
And it's really sad because those 5.5 seconds just define Jackie Smith in the eyes of everybody. When he's in the Hall of Fame, he revolutionized the position. As much as anybody, his yards per reception is the best ever amongst all tight ends. I think it's like 16.5. From Kentwood, Louisiana, I mean, his story's remarkable. He didn't really play much football in high school and college. And in the NFL, he's not only, you know, extending the game from that position by making plays down the field, But like on a team with Conrad Dobler, Dan Dierdorf, and another lineman who was in the World's Strongest Man. So you've got like the dirtiest player in football, one of the strongest men in America on your team. People say Jackie Smith was the dude you did not mess with.
Really?
Oh, all his teammates said that. Like they had story after story of, I mean, he's in street clothes, injured one game, and Terry Metcalf, the running back, takes a cheap shot from a Washington Redskin, and Jackie Smith runs onto the field in his street clothes to beat the hell out of this guy. And it gets stopped, and the ref says, get off the field. Like, he thought it was a crazed fan that ran on the field. So makes Jackie sit in a chair, like, away from the team. Fast forward, Jackie Smith is visiting his mom in Jackson, Mississippi, and his mom says, Jackie, there's a player for the Washington Redskins that just moved into the area. He wants to see you. So he's thinking, oh, my God, like Jesus Christ himself has delivered me my revenge. Like he's ready to beat this guy up. And he goes to the door. The player answers. He's got a fist clenched behind his back like he's ready to brawl. And it was somebody else. It was a different player. And they had a lovely chat about playing each other and everything. But there's just so many stories with Jackie Smith. Hopefully this book can kind of explain. And it got emotional. Like it's right up there with any conversation they had because here's an 82-year-old. We got together at a place called Cyberg's, like bar and restaurant in St. Louis, you know, his go-to spot. He's running into buddies there. But at one point, we ease into the play that has defined him. We didn't just jump right into it. But he's getting a tear in his eye. He's talking about how he let it affect his relationships, like with his kids, with his family, his loved ones. And it wasn't until just a couple years ago that he found a way to get over it. I mean, really, it's that recent. And I can't imagine living with that burden for decades.
Yeah.
I mean, decades, you're letting – he doesn't regret a thing. I mean, football provided so much for his family, and he himself was able to live with it, but the disappointment comes in letting it fester and affect, like, his relationships with loved ones. So I think that look-in-the-mirror moment at 80, that tells us so much about life, too. Mm-hmm.
So when you're out reporting, you're out drinking with Shockey, which I can only imagine. You're on the golf course with Ditka. You're even, you know, at the restaurant chatting with Jackie Smith. More when you're out and about. How are you reporting? Are you recording? Do you have a notebook out? Like, is it bouncing out? Like, are you just kind of hanging out and then taking notes? Like, how do you kind of create that interview without it being, like, maybe too formal or kind of balance that with catching them in their environment?
You know, I think it was Andy McCullough. You know, we went to school together at Syracuse. He's an excellent baseball writer now at The Athletic. He's just unbelievable, you know, friend, reporter, everything. You know, he put it best, like, back in college and just said, you don't have interviews, you have conversations. And you're not talking to sources, you're talking to human beings. It's no different than us sitting here talking and you know, any of us just hanging out, like, you want to be curious and learn something and make it as conversational and normal as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the pretense that this is an interview for a book, obviously, you know, you don't want to be sneaky about it. But I really just tried to think through that lens all the time and treat, you know, hanging out with these tight ends no different than I treat long form stories that I've written at Golong or anywhere. And, I think it's I went into each conversation like with a lot of research done. You know, a lot of documentaries have been broadcast and put out there on a lot of these tight ends. A lot of stories have been written in Sports Illustrated, ESPN the magazine, what have you. Like that was a challenge, honestly, with the book is, okay, a lot's been said, a lot's been written about these tight ends already. Like, how do you keep it fresh?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I want to find, like, war stories that nobody's heard before on these guys. Right. Like, make it worth people's time to invest, to read a book. How do you do that? When a lot's already out there. So I think the key is absorbing everything that's out there and then go in with an idea, like a rough sketch in your mind of like, okay, this could be a theme, that could be a theme, this could be an angle, but you don't want to be married to it. I think that's the worst thing to do is like go into one of these things with a notepad and dozens of pages of questions and topics and just going one to the next and having in your head, this is what, you got to be flexible because you don't know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be talking like this. You don't want to be talking like this. All right, Jeremy, up and down with your head going back and forth. So I think to answer your question, it definitely was just a conversation, you know, in their setting, ideally. You know, even everybody's thinking we were just talking at bars nonstop. Ben Coates was in his home. It wasn't all over beer. but making it as, you know, informal and real as possible to get the best mm-hmm. stories and the and what their lives were really like, what their lives are really like now. And I think we accomplished that.
So did you do all your own transcription?
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, my God. Oh, transcribing. So writing a book, that's definitely the – that's what eats up your time more than anything. Now, I've talked to – you know, there's a lot of people who did books, and some of them recommended, like, Otter. Does anybody use Otter? It's like a transcription service. There's some stuff out there. No. I could not stand it, Dustin.
No.
Yeah, so that – you know, I don't know. Maybe people have a system that works for them, but I did like the free trial on Otter where you put an interview in,
yeah.
it spits it back, and there were just mistakes. And I think you spend more time
correcting mistakes yeah.
than you would actually transcribing. So, yeah, I just decided to transcribe every single word from every single interview, and that made for – I got into a habit of doing it late at night for a while.
Okay.
And then, you know, we had two kids, one of them a newborn. It became much easier to wake up at about 3, 3.30 and bang out some transcribing in the morning than that.
So so how did you go about Jeff Perlman and I, the episode's out today as we record this. He's got the amazing book on Bo Jackson that's out. And so we talked a lot about.
Yeah, real nice of Jeff to put that out right around Blood and Guts. Huh? Thanks, Jeff.
he did like some insane like 700 interviews for it. How did you go about? So the point was Jeff and I talked about how he organizes the information and how he kind of like took all this information yeah. and made it usable to him as he was writing it. So what was your model for doing that? How did you take this transcript and all those clips and all the everything? How did you have it organized so that you could then sit down and write it?
I think a big benefit to this format for this book. Now, I definitely encourage everybody to read start to finish because there is a story arc mm-hmm. to it. I mean, one chapter does kind of bleed to the next, and there's a lot of commonalities and coaches they might have had and different themes that kind of develop, and you can really see how a Mike Ditka leads to a George Kittle, you know, chapter 1 to chapter 15 and everybody in between. But I did have the benefit of being able to kind of jump around in the reporting mm-hmm. and the writing because as I'm getting these tight ends, I'm writing chapters, and it's out of order. So that definitely helped. And I try to treat it like I would writing features at any of my jobs where I'm going to attack this as its own individual story and talk to as many people as I can, including the tight end, if they cooperate, hopefully. And, conduct as many interviews as possible, conversations mm-hmm. as possible, transcribe every single word, print it out.
You printed them all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
Print them out. I usually get like different highlighters,
all right,
and color code things, and see if like in my head I have a rough sketch of like okay, like what the sections will look like, how one topic is going to lead to the next, or one storyline is going to lead to the next, and that might be a certain color, or something else might be a certain color, and it's just being really active. I think with the copy helps. I think it's so beneficial too. Obviously you talk to the player. And then you're listening back to transcribe it, and then you're printing it out, and then you're reading it, and you're rereading it. Just constantly hearing what they said, how they said it, and then putting it through your brain again and again and again, 3-4 times over. It gives you such a command over how they said something and the purpose behind it, and how that's going to weave into a larger storyline. Yeah.
So I've heard you said before in other interviews and on your own podcast that like you kind of approach this book in a way like – however many tight ends there are, like 11 or 12 individual long-form feature stories, which you've been doing for years now. I'm curious, did that make it, I don't want to say easier, but did that make it a little less intimidating? Like, oh, my God, I'm writing a book. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm writing a feature on Ben Coates. I can do that.
Totally. Oh, it definitely helped big time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew they'd have to, like, fit together, and you've got to have a book. Yeah. It can't just be, you know, 4 or 5 guys, and that's a wrap. So there were some stressful moments, especially when you're, you know, banging at a door and nobody's answering and you're mm-hmm. trying to get somebody. And a lot of stuff did kind of work out toward the end of it. You know, I had my manuscript due in early March and I was able to get an extension to early April, if I have that right. So thank you, 12 Publishing, and Sean Desmond, the best publisher out there. Definitely needed that extra month because – I mean, like George Kittle, I got right at the end. Okay. You know, he wanted to get through his season and didn't really want to talk, you know, until it was wrapped up. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, he was all about it then. I want to say like Jimmy Graham, Jackie Smith, Dallas Clark. There were some really important tight ends that I got kind of on the back end of it.
Okay.
Where I was able to work on chapters, work on the writing, you know. I didn't start writing nearly as early as I should have.
Oh, really?
No.
Okay.
I started writing in like the weekend after Thanksgiving, I think.
Okay.
So if I did this over again, I would start writing a little sooner. But as you know, like when you're writing a story, you try to do as much reporting as you can before you even
sure
put pen to paper or start typing anything out.
Right.
Because you want to just like constantly ask questions and learn more and more and be curious about everything before you actually conceptualize it all into a story. It was a little stressful toward the end, honestly. I'm not going to lie. Like, even though with that extension, you've got to like put stuff together pretty quick.
As part of this week's episode, we're giving away a free signed copy of Tyler's new book, The Blood and the Guts. So here's how to enter. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Instagram. Make sure you're following The Other 51 and like the post for this week's episode. You'll know it when you see it. You have until Sunday, November 7th at midnight to enter, and we'll randomly select one person who's liked and followed us to win the book. And if you don't win, I hope you check out Tyler's book anyway. There are links in the show notes to buy it, either on Amazon or from your local indie bookstore. Along with writing a book, you're covering the NFL. This is during the NFL season that you're doing a lot of this reporting, so you're doing stuff for Go Long. You've mentioned you have you have a newborn and a toddler running around. Did you sleep in the past year? Probably not. But
well, you need to have an unbelievable wife. That's not my wife. That's my friend's wife. Yeah. Sorry, Tarla. I'm pointing emotion toward Tarla. Went to high school with cash. Right. It takes two. I mean, that's why, like, every opportunity on this radio podcast tour, mm-hmm. it's like, Gina was amazing. And it's not easy to be like, all right, honey, you got Sonny, our crying baby who is, 2, 3, 4 months old. I'm going to go throw back a beer with Jeremy Shockey. Like, no, it's work. But, there's a lot on the plate, man. I think it's just, it really is that old survive in advance cliche. Like, you're just one day to the next, mm-hmm. hope for the best, and go. I mean, you just do it. You just find a way to get it done. Like, yeah. It wasn't a matter of if. It was like, this will all get done, and we will just make it happen.
So you still an early morning writer now? We were talking about that last time you were on, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it used to be, I used to, like, transcribe maybe over, like, a glass of whiskey, mm-hmm. and just, you're working late at night and sleeping in till 7, 8. Now, we get up at like 4:30 each morning, so usually it's getting up with Sonny and maybe a little before.
Getting up with Sonny in the sun.
Yeah, exactly. The sun doesn't come up for another 3 hours, but.
So you mentioned the balancing out that kind of individual feature story on each tight end chapter versus the connective tissue of the story. What kind of a challenge was that? You know what the thread is, the saving football and that. But how much of a challenge is that as a writer to work that in kind of more organically? So it's not feature story and then paragraph. This is how Jeremy Shockey is saving. You know what I mean? Like, to kind of make that common thread more organic and part of a book rather than just here's the stories and, by the way, this is how they're connected.
I think that it does help that all of these guys – Like I said, the tight end position kind of chooses you because you are wired a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Mike Ditka was that top of the food chain, apex predator. Like, he will get revenge on you in every possible way. And Jeremy Shockey was the same way 40 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that those stories around Mike Ditka are going to be pretty similar to the stories around a Jeremy Shockey and a Rob Gronkowski and a George Kittle, to where it's organic. It's like, we heard from all of our journalism professors, like, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
There's definitely moments in the book where I'm driving a point home, like with Rob Gronkowski in the early 2010s and explaining why that era was so important. And this is where you're absolutely on board with me, Brian. The game's getting softer. It needed Rob Gronkowski to come through and remind everybody that they love the violence. Like, yeah, there's definitely points I think you kind of drive home a theme or like this is what this book is about. But for the most part, it's just show like it's just the crazy stories that kind of fit together. And individually, they all follow some really similar, similar but different. I mean, gosh, I don't want to give away the whole book here. So thanks everybody for reading. But like a Tony Gonzalez is wild in that. You know, nobody forced him to play football. Hmm. Like he just kind of did. He learned to love it himself. Like he was a bully. He was bullied when he was a kid. Like just relentlessly bullied. He said, "Look, I was a pussy." In his words. He said, "I was a wimp in every possible way. Hated getting hit. You know, his friends used to box with him and just beat him up." Hmm. And he kind of compared it to the Norwegian way. If you watch that HBO Real Sports on Norway and how they came to dominate the Winter Olympics, they, as a country, like they put in this system where there's no scores even kept at games, like your first like 13, 14 years of your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's no trophies handed out. Like if parents act up at games, like they're kicked out. They really wanted kids to learn to love a sport as opposed to being forced to play a sport. And then when you turn, I want to say 14 or 15, and you develop a love for sport, that it becomes more serious. They surround you with nutritionists and the right coaching, and next thing you know, they're kicking everybody's butts in the Olympics.
Right.
And Tony Gonzalez says, that was my life. Like, nobody forced me to play football, but he grew to love it. It got to a point in the hitting drill where he's going toe-to-toe with the hardest hitter on the team, and they're meeting like a couple of Rams, and he can't get enough. And next thing you know, he's revolutionizing the position. So, like, there's similar stories to that, but then there's Rob Gronkowski, who is dad, you know, Papa Gronk in the basement, has them all like striving to be the best of the best of the best in Buffalo, New York, and in every way. And he's, you know, beating his brothers up in mini sticks, and it's the exact opposite, right? He's got this dad who is like driving him in all the best possible ways. So there are a lot of common threads. You can see why these guys were tight ends, like that saved the sport because they had these qualities like deep within their souls, but there's some pretty interesting differences too.
So what was the best moment in the whole writing/publishing process? Was it the day you got the books? Was it the day you finished? Was it what was the best kind of most when you look back on this whole process and you're like, this is the best. Man. That's my favorite memory of this.
Honestly, I really think it was the conversations with these guys. Like it is really cool to hold a book, and especially when you know that all the work that went into it, and mm-hmm. some of those stressful nights and the hours and all the time that you poured into it. There are those kind of like just downright cool moments for sure. But it is, I mean, the best part about this job is the free education. You're always learning something,
mm-hmm.
and you're just having conversations with crazy ass dudes with crazy stories to share. Mm-hmm. I mean, hanging out with Jeremy Shockey at Yard House down in Miami, and he's storming in like a hurricane, you know, goes right to his bar stool. Bartender knows what to order him. He sits down and we're off. You know, next mm-hmm. thing you know, he's just blasting through one story after another on, you know, a bar fight back in high school where somebody throws a bottle at his head. He avoids it like the Matrix and knocks him out with one punch. And drinking dozens upon beers at the Guinness factory in Ireland, everything in between, and how he just created a culture at the U and the Giants. And I mean, it was just fun. Mm-hmm. It was just fun to get these guys in their element and hear all of their wild stories in a game where it's hard to get that. Like, mm-hmm. I think that 2022 with so many, with so many handlers and so many players, not even the handlers, so many players worried about how every word they say is going to be construed.
Sure.
And how it will be just kind of shot into the social media ether and what it could do for their brand. I think we get a lot of Russell Wilsons. There's a lot of like image massaging and image conscious athletes that are worried about we don't really see who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many guys, like we don't really know who. I mean, maybe that's really who Russell Wilson is. I'm picking on Russ, unfortunately, but I don't know. I feel like everybody's kind of worried about saying the wrong thing and worried about getting canceled and how it's going to be perceived. And is their marketing agent going to be upset if they say something that's a little too real, a little too authentic? And from Mike Ditka to Shockey to Gonzalez to Coach to Kittle to all these tight ends, they were just unbelievably honest. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so important to hang out in person
mm-hmm.
and be there, talk face to face, look them in the eyes, you know, in their environment, because that's how you get substance, mm-hmm. and that's how you get just, you know, real stories that people want to read, right? And
yeah.
and I think organically, back to your earlier question, it does kind of fit in to a larger point, which is the book.
So what is the best story you couldn't put in the book? Not for protect the innocent or whatever, but like that you had to cut for space. Like, best story you had that you had to leave on the chopping room floor.
I was going to say, there was about 5 different times in hanging out with Jeremy Shockey where he said, don't put this in the book. And it was a story that, if, maybe when we're not recording, I'll tell people. That's some pretty crazy stuff. You know what was, Lee Smith is a really fascinating tight end. Mm-hmm. So he played for the Bills, played for the Falcons, played, drafted by the Patriots, actually, when Gronk and Aaron Hernandez were there. But he's got an unbelievable story himself, where his dad got into the NFL when the NFL players were on strike, mm-hmm. and he kind of snuck in as a scab and ended up playing for about 6-7 years. Then he retired, and then like a lot of players, struggled to adjust to life after football. Had a business kind of go under, and just kind of just gave in to alcoholism, and it ate away at his life. He was just a different person mm-hmm. when he was drinking heavily. He'd come home and get really physical with Lee. Like, he took a lot of body blows and a lot of pinned up against the wall, and it was horrific as a young kid to go through that. And he was so honest getting into this all. And then Lee Smith, you know, as he got into becoming a teenager and in the high school, he went down the same road. I mean, he started drinking heavily and drinking and driving and said, I could have ended up in a ditch. Like, it's a miracle I'm even alive. Eventually, in college, gets into a fight with a teammate. First, he gets kicked out of Tennessee, gets to Marshall, gets into a fight with a teammate. His face breaks. You know, he's communicating by writing on index cards to his loved ones because he's got a feeding tube in. It's just unbelievable that he was able to turn it around, and he did. I mean, he broke the cycle in his family of just alcoholism and became this big, loving father and just the leader of every locker room he was in, one of the most beloved teammates that anybody's ever had. You talk to anybody about Lee Smith, and it's you have stories for days. So that was definitely a story I wish we could have got in the book. I talked to him kind of late in the game, and we have a grunter in there, Mark Bruner, in the 90s. Lee Smith would have been a good grunt, you know, for the 2000s, and I think like he put it. I mean, there's a lot of parallels to Mike Ditka too. I mean, Mike Ditka, looks back at his dad a little more fondly. They had a better relationship, but Mike Ditka's father was pretty physical with him. That was a different time. But in terms of just kind of getting into his own dark place of drinking too much and being depressed in Philly and needing that phone call from Tom Landry to change his life, I think a lot of these tight ends they get so close to a breaking point. Like Lee says, like, they all have an element of crazy in them. Like, you have to be a little crazy to play this game. Think about how weird football is. Training camp. It's 90 degrees. Your coworkers, you're beating each other up. You're probably going to get into a fight at some point. Fights break out in training camp. And then you take the pads off and you go into the cold tub and you talk about your kids and your family. It's just weird. There's nothing like that. You don't go to the pharmacy and beat each other up like that. So it takes a certain level of crazy to operate. And like these tight ends, like, we're so good at getting close to that line of self-destruction without fully crossing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why they're able to last and really go down as legends of the game.
Did you interview Gronk about The Last Singer? Or not The Last Singer, a Masked Singer.
I did not.
You should have, dude. I called that. So,
do people actually watch The Masked Singer?
When my daughter was a little,
commercials are on all the time, and nobody actually.
My daughter was a little younger. We did. We went through a phase where we watched it. It was awful. You know, it was a train wreck. We watched it for the train wreck.
I thought you were going to say we're huge fans.
Oh no, no. But there was a Gronk was on 1 year, and like they have these little hint, like the mess, and they have these little montages where they give hints about them. And there was one I saw, and there was an 87, like you talked about being a football player and his voice is masked, and I saw like an 87. I'm like, that's Gronk. And you just learned this. I told you this. Nobody else knows this. I have the best icebreaker fact about yourself, that Gronk is my cousin. Legit, he is my great – we share – that goes back. We share a great-great-grandfather. Because my grandmother was a Gronkowski. So like we're third cousins. Never met him, but my family, like the older members of my family, knew of Gordy, his dad, before the Gronks made the NFL.
Gordy's story is pretty wild too.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah.
So anyway, Bummed about that, but yeah, I'm glad my cousin's in a book.
I like it.
Yeah. So, all right. So we have the traditional last question on this podcast, but we've got a room full of beautiful, smart people here at the Giandoli School at Bonaventure. So I want to open it up for questions. So just raise your hand or shout out questions that you have for Tyler about the book, about football, about the NFL. We'll open this up, make it open. So, yes.
Dr. Paul, my dad was a football coach. My brothers all played football and stuff. And I teach the coaching classes here. But Gronk and Brady left to go to the Bucs. And now Gronk retired, but Brady stayed on, and things aren't going too well. In terms of one player being there for the other player, and it's really a partnership, do you think that without Gronk, there's not that magic to, you know, the tight end, the famous tight end and the famous quarterback?
So just to repeat for listeners, the question is, with Gronk retiring and Brady coming back, is there something missing there, do you think, for Brady?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great point, because I think the relationships between the quarterbacks and the tight end, and that's like one of those subplots to the book, is such a special relationship. I mean, Drew Brees, the way he talked, or Drew Brees, yeah, he's, man, Drew Brees and Jimmy Graham, but mm-hmm. Drew Bledsoe, the way he would talk about Ben Coates, it's like, man, early in my career, I was looking for 87. Like, he was my best friend on the field, and then Peyton Manning and Dallas Clark, they were best friends off the field as well. I mean, they're pulling pranks on teammates and, you know, setting up a garbage can full of water up against a door in training camp and wait, knocking on the door. They open it up and the water goes everywhere. And then on the field, I mean, he's going to him in every clutch situation, because in, you know, some humdrum day of May, you know, just on a random field, who knows where, they're going over the same route 25 times. Like, one play again and again and again, down to the inch, so they know exactly where each other are going to be in that moment. I think it's a special relationship, and Brady and Gronk absolutely had that in New England. They had it in Tampa Bay. I think it was interesting that when Gronk retired, right away, Drew Rosenhaus says, well, you know, there's a chance Tom Brady calls and he's back. Like, the announcement that he's going to retire comes out, then seconds later we hear from Gronk's representation that, well, it might not really be a retirement. If Tom Brady gives him a call late in the season, you know, we'll see what happens. His presence and Gronkowski not being there, it's got to be affecting Tom Brady. Now, I think probably a certain divorce might be affecting Tom Brady even more, like in his personal life and everything he's going through there. God can only imagine. But not having Gronk's got to be a reason that he's struggling.
What else you guys want to know?
I'll keep firing questions. All right, the tight end, since you're from Western New York, and Pop Warner. So do you know the whole history of how the tight end position even started?
I tried to explain it as best as I could in the book. Mike Ditka and George Halas and Luke Johnsos. And
back to Pop Warner. So football back in the turn of the last century was just, it was like war. Two, you know, the guys in the line. And Pop Warner was assigned a coach at Carlisle, so he had these skinny, fast kids, Native Americans. There's no way that they were going to be able to fight. So he developed the whole backfield game. So that's how, from New York, Western New York, and Pop Warner, who started that whole backfield game.
It was a different game then. I mean, you know, even through the 40s and 50s, where you had a split end, you know, Don Hutson or Raymond Berry out there, and then an end. You know, you're just an extended lineman. Maybe you run a few yards, catch a ball, and fall down. But it was wild to hear how Ditka and Mackey just changed everything, because they had to differentiate the split end from the end, because this end that never was anything to really talk about, you know, in the grand scheme of things, was making so many plays.
I had a question for you. So your day job, you have to run your own business, your own Substack and all that. But then you also have a book to do. But, you know, like, if you're a reporter at a big news organization, you may take a leave while you work on your book and you're not worried about the day-to-day stuff. But you have to keep that going. So how do you balance all that at the same time?
Oh, my gosh. I wish I had a clear and concise answer to that one, Dean. I mean, it was just kind of everything all at once, all the time. Because you're right, I didn't want to short my subscribers at all. You know, and sorry, if I'm kind of cutting ahead enough for the podcast. So just on like balance and work and you know, the book and the day job and the family. Yeah, I didn't want to like short circuit and cheapen the go long product because that's still so new. And a lot of people are signing up. A lot of people are subscribing. So I still tried to travel around and do stories that were worth their time and their money on top of the tight end stuff. I mean, there might have been – I know when I saw Ben Coates in North Carolina, I rented a car and then drove down to Jacksonville and did a story on LaVisca Chenault for the Jaguars. He has a pretty wild story. I mean, he got him getting off topic. But, like, when he was a kid, he was in the car with his parents and – his dad like got out of the car and was tragically hit and killed, and he saw it all as a kid. I just can't imagine how that affected him. But so I tried to like tie the two endeavors together once in a while if I could, you know, in terms of like the reporting trips. But yeah, it was just meant for a lot more hours. Honestly, there's no magic pill. It was just like a lot more early mornings and late nights and burning at both ends. And like I said, an amazing wife to kind of carry a lot at home with the kiddos.
I'll throw one at you that you've probably never heard before. So, there's this guy from Western New York named Cali Dunn. He covered the NFL, you know, kind of made a name for himself. You got your own endeavor now. What do you want the name Cali Dunn to mean to people, to football fans 10 years down the road?
Ooh. Oh, Dustin Green coming in hot. Man, Dustin. Honestly, I mean, I hope that when it comes to football fans reading the book or reading Go Long, I just hope that they know they're gonna learn something, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be worth their time. It's going to be different than everything they're inundated with on social media and most of media, where it's just I'm gonna tell a story in an old school way, but more than anything, I just want to be a good dad, good husband, raise a family. Mm-hmm. That means more than any of this other stuff.
Well, you have a great family, so I hope you out.
Yeah. Now that you've already written a book, do you have plans for a second book? And if so, what would it be about?
Gosh, that's a good question too. I'm not really sure what it's gonna be. I definitely want to do another book. Being here in Western New York, there's got to be something Bills, right? I mean, we're going to see what happens this year, but some type of manifesto on the Bills could be worth the time, worth the deep dive. I don't know. I haven't really taken it any farther than just random thoughts in the back of my head.
So you're bouncing off of that. It's a great question. What lessons from this book are you going to take into book two?
I think budgeting time is really important, and you know, you really have to kind of map. Not that it was rushed or hurried or anything, but I didn't know what I was getting into. Honestly, I've never written a book before in terms of, like, all right, setting up the interviews, having the conversations, transcribing those conversations, mm-hmm. and then, like we said, the whole process that goes into it. Like, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of work. So I think just kind of knowing exactly what's coming in, like setting personal deadlines on top of the deadlines that you might have from a publisher definitely helps. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's just being passionate about the topic. And I wasn't sure initially how into this I would be. Okay. Like, to your point on like tight ends. Like, so when I was just kind of racking my brain around pure football, saving football, how best to tell that story in the book form. And when I initially came to tight ends, I wasn't as gung-ho about it day one as I was, you know, day 100 and 200 after actually sitting down with mm-hmm. Tony Gonzalez and Mike Dick and all these guys. So I kind of like eased into really being, oh my God, like I think we're onto something here. Like, this is a book that people are going to actually want to read. We have something. So I kind of bet on myself in that regard. And like, all right, these conversations are going to yield some results, but that's definitely will be on my head into any future project, is making sure that you love it, because it's on your head. It's on your brain all the time, whether you want to separate or not. You really can't, because it's always looming. Right? Like, that date is creeping closer and closer, and you want to produce something that, I mean, yeah, it's important for it to sell, and I hope you know, people enjoy it and buy it and share it. But, like, you want to be proud of something. When you put so much time into it, like, you just want to be proud of it. And I'm definitely happy with how this turned out and would take on another project in the future.
So I ask every guest on The Other 51 this. I've asked you however many thousands of times you've been on. So I'll ask you again, what's the best thing you've read lately?
I should know by now that that's kind of boring.
The own book?
Nobody has ever said their own book.
Oh, God, no. You know, I just started it, so, and I know the quality of his work, so it's going to be phenomenal. But Jeff Perlman's Bo Jackson book, The Life and Myth?
Yes.
Unbelievable. I'm only, you know, a few chapters in, but it's every bit as exceptional as you would expect out of Jeff. So let's go with that.
It's I'm with you on that. It is, if you've read Jeff Perlman's stuff, you know how good he is, and it's the perfect match of subject for a biography and writer. And you can listen to my interview with Jeff that came out last week alongside this one. So, all right, people want their book signed, so we're going to shut up and let them get their book signed. So thank you to the Giandoli School for hosting us
on
our live event.
It's
thank
awesome
you guys for
here.
All coming out. And Ty, thanks again, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Brian. All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thanks for listening to The Other 51. Show notes for this and all of our episodes can be found at sportsmediaguide.com by clicking on The Other 51 tab. If you like the show, please consider giving it a rating and a review, either at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help people find the show. Our theme music is by Ellie Moritz.